This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at how some Americans are protesting where our tax money goes.
Take your dollar bill, cut it roughly in half, and paste half of it onto a drone, because that's what your taxes are paying for.
We'll talk with attorney Pardis Cabriai from the Center for Constitutional Rights about her recent article in Harper's Magazine called Life After Guantanamo.
It's the heartbreaking tale of a father and a son imprisoned without evidence for 7 years, finally released, but to where? To two separate countries, and they haven't been allowed to see each other during the next 7 years.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, recently when the Cubans and the United States began the series of dialogues that will ultimately lead to diplomatic relations and perhaps some lifting of the embargo, there was a lot of discussion as whether a condition of that for the Cubans would be giving up Assata Shakur, who is living in Cuba after having been liberated from a prison in the United States for a crime or a murder she didn't commit. And it apparently did come up in those discussions. And at that point, I had said, well, I don't think there's any chance that Assata will ever be given over to the United States at the U.S. demand. And now apparently there's some new information on that issue that you're going to inform us about.
Well, the reason you said that, Michael, is that you and I and Heidi understand how deeply principled the Cuban government is. And there were some progressive Cuba bashers out there that thought, well, as part of this new diplomatic situation, they're going to give up Assata. And we all said no. But there was a very interesting interview with Louis Free in a New Jersey newspaper last week, which proves our point, Michael.
Who's
and
Louis
Heidi.
Free?
He was the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the head of the FBI, and he came forward and said this. He said, the FBI approached the Cuban government and said, if you'll give us Assata Shakur, we'll free the Cuban Five.
This was how long ago?
This was several years ago when the Five were still in prison, framed up for essentially trying to combat terrorism directed against people and property in Cuba by the counter-revolutionaries stationed in Florida. And the Cuban Five were falsely accused of conspiracy to commit espionage and put in five separate Maximax prisons around the country for some of them for 15 years. In any case, when the FBI proposed the deal, the Cubans didn't even deign to answer them. So that's the answer that the Cuban government gave to this country, that they wouldn't give up Assata Shakur for anything.
Well, we're glad to hear that. It's not that you and I and Heidi would have expected any different answer, but it's nice to always be reaffirmed in those beliefs.
Ratner, you just returned from Florida. What's happening down there?
Well, you know, Heidi and Michael, I go annually because it's the march and protest by CIW, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, that takes place every year. Usually it's a week or two march through Florida and other states, actually. This time it was a 1 or 2 day affair in St. Petersburg, Florida. And it was that because they decided to hold a big, you would call it a victory concert, because they've won many of their struggles. These are struggles over getting a penny more a pound for the workers in the field, as well as getting monitors in the field to avoid abuse, and really forcing companies to join the Fair Food Program. And they've won many. Every fast food company you buy from, with one exception, and that's Wendy's. And they've also won against a number of supermarkets, Whole Foods and others. But they haven't yet won against Publix or Wendy's. So it was a celebration of their victories, but also really an impetus to go on and win against Wendy's and Publix. And it was an extraordinary occasion. We started with a march through the streets of St. Petersburg, big floats, music, colorful signs, 2,000 people going through St. Petersburg with this kind of music, ending up right on the shore of the Gulf with a huge concert stage and having groups who were really came almost for very little, if nothing. Rudy Vallée and a group called the Solophonics, La Santa Cecilia, an amazing Mexican group from Los Angeles, and one that a lot of people had heard of, Ozomatli. And it was really a great concert with thousands attending. The demands were Wendy's and Publix to sign the Fair Food Agreement. And at that concert, a number of student organizations who had come from all over the country, let me just say they'd taken 22-hour bus rides from places like Ohio State, from Boston, from New York, and they got there for a day, spent the day and the night, and got on the buses that night after the concert and went back to their schools. So some 45 hours on the bus, you know, hundreds, perhaps thousands of people on those buses coming for this demonstration. So it's really grabbed onto particularly young people, but others as well. What was announced at this concert was that a number of the schools are going on boycotts against Wendy's, which is to say Wendy's has a number of its franchises on college campuses or nearby. And those are the ones that really can get to Wendy's, because students will join the boycotts and those Wendy's will be forced in the end and force Wendy's to sign the Fair Food Agreement. So it was an exhilarating time. Of course, as I should disclose, my son works for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, as does his partner, Elena Stein. They've been there some 4 years and have done some great organizing. For more information and to support them, and I recommend it, go to two websites. One is CIW-online.org, CIW-online.org, and the other is called the Alliance for Fair Food. It's an affiliate of Allies of the CIW, and that's at AllianceForFairFood.org.
As April 15th draws near, some Americans engage in the practice of war tax resistance, refusing to pay some or all of their federal income tax. It's an act of civil disobedience with a proud history in this country. Notable war tax resistors included Henry David Thoreau, who refused to pay his poll tax during the Mexican-American War. In the 1960s and 70s, many Vietnam War protesters also engaged in the practice, including Norman Mailer, Howard Zinn, James Baldwin, and Joan Baez. While individuals refusing to pay war taxes cite the refusal as a moral imperative, even citing international law to bolster this assertion, it's not surprising that the Internal Revenue Service considers the refusal to pay such taxes as illegal. Here to discuss the practice of war tax resistance is Ruth Benn, coordinator of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. Along with Ed Hedeman, she edited the fourth and fifth editions of the book War Tax Resistance, A Guide to Withholding Your Support from the Military, published by the War Resisters League. Ruth Benn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
It's nice to see you, Ruth. My first question is, where do our taxes go?
Well, in war tax resistance, we tend to use the War Resisters League chart where your income tax money really goes. And the calculations from War Resisters League over the years have been around 50%. This year, it's, 46% or something like that between current and past. But who knows? You know, there's a lot of hidden money there, too.
Where do they go, the 46 or 50%?
Yeah, well, a certain part of it, about 27%, is current military. So that's paying for the wars, and it's buying the weapons for the next wars and all of those things that the Pentagon does. And the 18% past military for the coming, this is actually the proposed budget from Obama, for the coming fiscal year, which starts in October. But the past military is mostly interest on the debt, and then some, and then the veterans, the money that's set aside for veterans. But, you know, we're only going to see that grow over the coming years because they've been borrowing so much for the current.
So we're at about 45% for military, past, future, and today. Is that right?
Yes.
Under Obama's new budget, if that goes
right.
Right.
At least $586 billion. Is that right?
For current military?
That's for the Pentagon specifically, yes. And then the military has a lot of money in other departments. So the nuclear weapons program, which they're increasing over the coming 10 years, modernizing weapons and modernizing the delivery systems, Obama is increasing that money for the nuclear weapons. So that's in the Department of Energy. Of course, we have the Department of Homeland Security now. So why isn't that the Department of Defense, so to speak? But that is a lot of armed people also, the TSA and the border and the militarization of the border. So, and the Homeland Security is giving those grants to local, to communities in the U.S. that are getting these military weapons. You can see what the NYPD is doing with them in New York, but around the country we have small police forces with this military equipment that's coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. So those are all in other departments.
But are those included in the 47% when
yes,
you say it?
Yes, yes.
So
the
it's
State
roughly
Department.
Half our money goes into these various weapon systems.
Plus, how much money goes to pay for wounded veterans and past wars?
We have $500 billion in this year for veterans and past military, but that's only going to add up. And I don't know if people might have seen recently, there was a little story about how there are still a couple people who are ancestors of Civil War vets who are still getting a little Civil War payment. So we're going back a long time for military debt.
It's fascinating. And I understand that we're also paying interest on the national debt. It amounts to nearly $340 billion.
Right. That's what's included in the pie chart is the interest on the debt. That's what
it's
we're
astonishing.
Paying through our income taxes is the interest on the debt.
Let's talk about what is war tax resistance, because a lot of our listeners may not know what forms this takes.
Well, it's similar to conscientious objection to the military in terms of people who've refused to go into the military, refused the draft at different times when there was a draft. So this is a refusal to have my tax dollars drafted, a refusal to pay income taxes that go into this pie of the military budget, people who don't want to pay for war. And there are various ways of doing that, but that's, you know, essentially at times in the U.S. history, and certainly with other countries, there's been a particular tax that was put on people for war, or during the World War II, a stamp that people had to buy that was on their cars that supported war. So then it was easier to resist because you had this particular tax. But now,
and so would people just deduct that amount from their taxes and make a statement?
That was bought separately. It was a separate thing. You had to buy this stamp, this thing that went on your car or something like that. So it was easy to say, I'm not buying it and I'm not going to show it on my car.
And what was the penalty for that?
Well, Ernest Bromley, I think, in World War II was one of the first people to do that. And, you know, I think he spent some time in jail. I actually can't remember offhand all the details, but he was certainly, he was a minister and he was ostracized from his church and also was penalized in other ways.
Well, there have been some famous tax resisters over the years, haven't there?
Sure. I mean, we tend to go back to Henry David Thoreau, of course, with his $1 that resulted in his on the duty of civil disobedience. And I think most of us wish that we could have that kind of impact by resisting just a dollar in the way that he did. But, I always say going throughout history, I mean, taxes tend to be first put on people because somebody wants to fight somebody, right? A government wants to go to war. So that's decades and centuries back. And I'm sure that there have been people who've refused those taxes throughout history. In the U.S., there's Thoreau, yes. And Vietnam War, of course, was probably the biggest time for war tax resistance when it really was a strong part of the peace movement. And so we had Joan Baez and Gloria Steinem signing a letter about war tax, refusing to pay for war. Allen Ginsberg and many other well-known anti-war activists who were part of the war tax resistance movement then.
Did anybody go to jail during that period for not paying taxes?
There were certainly prosecutions. I'm probably missing somebody who actually went to jail, but certainly prosecutions, even for small amounts. If you're talking about the campaign during Vietnam to resist the telephone tax, which had a long association with war attacks, that was put on and raised during Vietnam. It was raised to 10% during the Vietnam War just to pay for the wars. And so people would owe like $7 in phone tax. And some of them had their houses seized. Some of them had bicycles and cars seized.
I remember representing people like this.
That kind of collection. And then there were other technical cases related that people probably did go to jail and just kind of...
But it was a big movement. I remember a lot of people didn't pay the telephone tax.
Yes, yes. That was up to maybe 250 or 1,000 people or half million. It was a big campaign.
Nowadays, if I want to partake of this, do I deduct half of my federal taxes and put a note in saying I refuse to pay? What do people do?
That's one way to do it. Certainly, to be a war tax resister, you have to owe some taxes to begin with.
We all aspire to that.
Yeah.
Just like in the Second World War, to put that sticker on your car, you had to own a car.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So within the network of war tax resistors, and I hesitate to call it a movement these days, but it certainly is a strong network around the country, there are people who do a whole range of things. Some live on a very low income, which is a legal way to do it. I mean, the cutoff for filing and owing taxes is around $10,000 for a single person. So to live on that is not easy. Some people, and those people tend not to file and just tend to stay out of the system and be off the grid or whatever and not get involved with the federal tax system at all. There are other people in the network who are more adept at using credits and deductions to lower their taxable income and figuring out how much they can live on and then maybe take classes and do education credits and put money in an IRA and things like that that are going to bring their taxable income down to zero so that they're avoiding paying anything. And then there are others of us, myself included, who do owe taxes at the end of the year. And I do file, and yes, I do enclose a letter saying why they're not getting their $1,000 or whatever it is that I owe that year. It's usually around somewhere between $1,000 and $1,400. And I resist the federal income tax portion.
And you've been doing this for a number of years.
A long time. I think in 87 I started very consistently filing and refusing to pay.
And what does the IRS say to you about this?
You get a lot of letters. I have files and files of collection letters. Of course, they add up interest and penalties. And when you file and they accept your 1040 as you filed it, they have 10 years to collect. So happily, I have actually a lot of years that are out of the statute of limitations and no longer, they can no longer collect, but they're always 10 years open. And for whatever reason, you know, I actually, now I'm self-employed. So the IRS can do things like garnish salaries. So people who are have a W-2 and are on salary, it's fairly easy for them by computer to do that kind of collection or to take money from bank accounts. So over the years, I've kind of figured out how to live in a way that makes it harder for them to collect. Not that they couldn't make my life difficult. And I did get called in, it was maybe 2009, I think they started looking at me. And I had a couple meetings with the IRS, and I took them the pie chart, where your tax money goes, and Thoreau's on the duty of civil disobedience. So the IRS agent didn't seem to be very impressed by that, but a lot of people still are. And I had a couple meetings with them, and in that case, they didn't pursue it. And I don't know, you know, if it's because some of us who are very open about what we do, they'd rather not engage, or, you know, mostly the IRS would rather get the money than prosecute people. So it's pretty rare to go to jail, although it does happen. But.
I read that some resistors do things like withhold a symbolic amount. The U.S., for example, they might hold back $17.76, symbolic of the revolutionary year, or people writing checks on toilet seats or mock-up missiles. And Julia Butterfly Hill apparently resisted $150,000 in taxes, but then gave the money elsewhere to environmental groups, mm-hmm. arts groups, saying that she wasn't refusing to pay, but she was paying where she thought tax money should go.
Yeah.
Right. These seem like creative programs designed to get public awareness about the tax resistance out there.
Right, right. We do try. Yes, Julia was a big case. She had a legal settlement that had this huge tax bill on it. And that was right at the early period of the Iraq invasion and war. And she found that she absolutely just couldn't make herself send this to the government. So she has also been a person who's figured out over this decade that she's been resisting how to live her life in a way that's pretty much off the grid, that you know, the money has been used in other programs and other groups. And I think the IRS has not been able to collect. And I did just get a note from her that she is still resisting and redirecting. But I had been in touch with her because we had actually seen some news from Hong Kong that some of the democracy activists there, there's a certain group who started tax resistance, and they were inspired by Julia and another war tax resistor here. So that was just, you never know when
the
a seed is planted.
Yeah, the and you effect. Used a term redirecting, which would mean to take that money, instead of paying it to the government, you give it elsewhere.
Right, and that's what I do also. And probably most people in our network do it. Some people will set the money aside. They'll leave it in a bank account. And if the IRS comes to collect, then, you know, they'll get the principal anyway, maybe not all the interest
and
penalties, but it's a less painful hit if you're going to be collected on at some point. So people have different ways of dealing with it. But redirection has become an important part. And most of us have given away a lot of money over the years. And I usually send a note when I'm, you know, sending my check to some group or media outlet or whoever I happen to think is doing good work and not killing people. I usually send a note saying, this is why you're getting this money.
We're speaking with Ruth Benn from the War Resisters League. And Ruth, would you mind if I ask you more of a personal question? How'd you get involved in doing this?
Well, I had in the late 70s, actually, I lived up in Northampton, Massachusetts, and some of you probably know Francis Crowe. I got active in the peace movement with the American Friends Service Committee, and I'm not a Quaker myself, but war tax resistance tends to be known pretty well in the Quaker community. A lot of Quakers have been strong resistors over the years. So I learned about it, and at the time, we were also doing outreach to young people about refusing to register for selective service, and I really felt like, well, it was never going to affect me registering for selective service or being drafted if they ever have a draft again, but I could resist taxes because that was sort of similar in that way to me, and that's something I could do. So I started then kind of, you know, in small ways, more like the, you know, $5, $10, probably wasn't making much money at the time, resisted the phone tax. And then over the years, I did take a trip to Israel and Palestine, and it certainly was one of the most militarized places I'd ever seen. And knowing that U.S. tax dollars were buying all those weapons was very upsetting to me. So that's when I started 100% income tax resistance.
I have a question about what you do now. How does it work if people want to not pay? Do you give advice to them? Your materials, are there laws about what you can tell people? I'm a lawyer, but I don't know this, whether I can, quote, encourage people not to pay taxes.
Well, I'm sure that the government, if they wanted to, could find some conspiracy charge for any of us. Certainly they did with draft counselors, and it could probably be similar. I think, you know, in terms of the way that we counsel people or talk to people about how to do it, usually try to say, this is what I do, this is what some people do, and you make your own choice. I mean, we don't fill out tax forms for people or anything like that. So it's a very non-directive kind of counseling, which perhaps in a legal sense is better. But we have lots of information on our website.
And what is that website?
Well, actually, War Resisters League does have a section on war tax resistance, and that's warresisters.org. And I also work with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, a long name, and our website is the initials of the organization, nwtrcc.org. And we have a network around the country that's on our website so people can hopefully find somebody local to talk to.
And you're co-editor of a book also, right?
Yes, the War Tax Resistance Guide that's published by War Resisters League.
Ruth, what would it take for you to start paying taxes?
Well, you know, I have been doing it a long time, and there was that period there, like before the first Gulf War and Was it then or was it? I mean, I guess it was after that. And actually, at the time around when Mandela became president in South Africa, there was a little period in there where things were looking really hopeful. And I really did at that time, whatever else was going on, say to myself, could I get out of this someday? I mean, it is kind of crazy. You know, I'm carrying around maybe $25,000 or so in debt to the IRS. So there's a point where you go, what am I doing? But I don't know, these days, you just have to look at the news and I just can't, I can't imagine it right now. I don't know.
Well, given the current circumstances, Ruth, have you seen an uptick in interest from people in learning about this subject?
Oh, I wish that was true. And in some ways, you know, it's harder to tell than it used to be because people go to the internet and they don't call us like they used to. But the best the surge was really right in 2003 when the U.S. went into Iraq. And, you know, war-tax resistance kind of rises and falls with the peace movement, and we can kind of see that the peace movement is at a low ebb. We'd certainly like to have better connections with climate change people because many of us see the war and military as being both the biggest polluter on Earth and the biggest user of money that could be redirected to, you know, some other programs. So it's a kind of a low period, but there are always new people. You know, there are always people who call or write and say, I just can't write that check this year.
And does that happen around this time of year?
Pre-tax? Oh, yeah. Well, there are more people calling now, yes. Certainly before April 15th, yeah.
Ruth, in the few minutes that we have left, tell us about any current tax resistors. Who are they? What did they do?
You know, I can't think of anyone in particular. They're really all walks of life. You know, people tend to be, the ones I know about tend to not be making thousands of dollars a year. But most people have been active in the peace movement. I wouldn't say people come to war tax resistance as the first thing they suddenly do. Usually you've been active for a while and you go, oh, I'm paying for this. you know, I'm paying for what I'm fighting against. So you know, people come into it that way. There is a fellow recently from upstate New York named Joseph Olajek who was in prison recently. He did 26 weekends in jail, and he stopped paying in 1994, I think, around the time that the U.S. had the sanctions on Iraq, and he was disgusted by the policy on Iraq at that time. And he actually did get prosecuted by the IRS, taken to court last year, and he ended up making a plea agreement with them. But he's become very involved with the Quakers in upstate New York now. And he actually has his diaries, his journals from being in jail are running in the Friends Journal, that magazine right now. So people could read about his story. He's also on our website. We have his story on our website. And there have been a couple others who've had some sort of tricky situations with their taxes. I mean, one guy did. He didn't report all his income, and that's not really a wise choice with the IRS. They do tend to notice those, especially if it's a fairly high chunk of change. So he was also in jail for a year. That was about four years ago, something like that. So there are a few people who have been taken to court, but it's pretty rare, and it's usually something they've done in their taxes that stands out.
It's too bad the movement hasn't grown exponentially mm-hmm. with our militarization, because this would be such a strong public statement, and even court cases involving this would be an opportunity to bring this into the public forum.
And that may be one reason why the IRS does not take too many people to court. You know, they don't want to make it public. Yeah. I think those of us who do it think, yes, this should be a stronger part of the movement. But in some ways, there are also so many different ways of doing it that it makes it hard to pull people together. And people don't like talking about money and their income and what they've got and what they're doing with their taxes. That's a hard thing to break through. You know, you don't sit around and talk about that to people usually. So I think that makes it hard to organize. But we're out there, and, you know, hopefully people will find us and get active somehow and get involved.
Ruth Benn, give us the website again, would you please?
Mm-hmm. The National War Tax is nwtrcc.org and warresisters.org, or people can just search on war tax resistance and we'll pretty much come right up.
Well, Ruth Benn, you're a model citizen.
I'd love to see it.
Yes. Great
Thank
to
you.
Have you on.
Thank you
Thanks,
very much.
Ruth.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
September 11, 2001, the United States gave bundles of cash to Afghan warlords and the Pakistani government to assist in capturing suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. Hundreds of men were turned over to the U.S. custody, often without evidence. This was an unfortunate starting point of how human lives were destroyed to, as some suggest, justify an illegal war launched by the Bush administration. Center for Constitutional Rights Senior Staff Attorney Pardis Kebriai, April Harper's Magazine article entitled Life After Guantanamo, A Father and Son's Story, traces the human toll of how her clients were wrongly imprisoned. After being picked up in Pakistan, sent back to Afghanistan, detained in Kandahar, Abdul Nasser Kantumani and his son Muhammad were interrogated by the United States and sent to Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba. Attorney Pardis Kebriai joins us to talk about the case and her recent article.
Pardis, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pardis, we've all read, as many other people have, your extraordinary article in the recent issue of Harper's called Life After Guantanamo, A Father and Son Story. And in that story, you talk about a father and son who you represented at Guantanamo and who are now living respectively in Portugal and in
Cape Verde.
So let's start from how did you first get involved with these two clients? And tell us a little bit of their story of your meeting and what went on from there.
Sure. So I started at TCR in 2007, and it was actually, it took a year for me to be able to go down to the base because I had to get my security clearance in that process. You know, you're interviewed by the FBI, and there are all these background checks, and so that process takes a while if you've traveled a bit and you know, you've got a certain background. So I went down for the first time in mid-2008, and that was the first time that I met Muhammad. Muhammad was the son. He was a teenager when he was taken into U.S. custody. By the time I met him, you know, he'd been at Guantanamo for 6 years, 6 years without charge. And what I say in the piece is that I think he started sort of breaking down, really kind of cracking in 2005 after he'd been at Guantanamo for a couple of years already and had really tried for many years to defend himself and to explain why he was being wrongfully held, was really kind of trying and I think for a while believing that he might actually be released because he, you know, he knew that he was wrongfully there, that he and his father were swept up wrongfully and that they... It was a mistake, like hundreds of other people who were at Guantanamo. But by the time we met in 08, you know, he'd really kind of given up. So he was in very bad shape. CCR had taken on his case a couple of years before in 2006. So by the time I'd come on, you know, he'd had lawyers who had been trying to meet with him, trying to keep him alive, trying to keep hope alive, but, you know, again, by 2008, he'd kind of given up, and he was ready to tell us all to go away, to dismiss his case, to just sort of stop everything we're doing because he was convinced he was never going to leave. And he was saying things like, you know, I don't care if I'm here for another 5 years, another 10 years, I'm never getting out. So he was in a lot of despair. He'd been held in solitary confinement continuously for about 2 years at that point. And again, just keep in mind how young he was. I mean, that's torture for everyone, but he was a kid when he was seized. And then there was this additional aspect of the way that his relationship with his father, Abdel Nasser, was used to traumatize him. They were captured together, transferred to Guantanamo together, but then pretty much held apart in prison, you know, in the same prison, but held in different camps and different cells. And by the time we met, you know, Abdel Nasser had been away from him for a couple of years, and the interrogators would sort of use their relationship and use his dad to pressure him to speak out against his dad, to make statements against him, to sort of to say that he was a member, his dad was a member of Al-Qaeda, which he denied, which he wasn't. When Mohammed would refuse to cooperate, you know, quote unquote cooperate, they would punish him and they would take Abdel Nasser away. So, you know, there was sort of this back and forth that happened continuously, and it was just completely traumatic to Mohammed. So we met in 08, and then, you know, November of 2008 when we met, and in December, he cut his wrist. He doesn't call it suicide because he didn't want to die. He just didn't know what to do, and it was really just a complete act of despair.
The prison officials had a cold response to that.
Yeah, you know, it's along the lines of the way the military has and the government has responded every time there are acts of despair by and acts of protest by prisoners, you know, protesting their arbitrary detention and their torture, which is to deny it or just sort of respond really callously. So when Mohammed cut his wrist, you know, he used a piece of metal in his cell to cut one of his wrists. He took the blood and smeared it on the walls and wrote "America is the country of injustice" on the wall. He started beating his head against the wall. We filed an emergency motion in court asking the court to move him out of solitary, to get him close to his father, to do something. And the government's response was to file, you know, three or four declarations from the commander who was in charge of intelligence, the commander in charge of medical care, and commander in charge of detention operations, all saying that, no, actually, Mohammed was just very, you know, very disruptive prisoner, and that he had narcissistic traits, that he had basically a personality disorder, and that he was doing this just to get attention, trying to manipulate his lawyers as he had manipulated the prison staff to, you know, to get attention. You know, this is the same prison, same officials who 2 years earlier had called the first deaths at Guantanamo a good PR move, you know, asymmetric warfare. So it wasn't surprising, but it's still kind of shockingly callous every time. And, you know, it continues to the present. So the latest hunger strike, mass hunger strike at Guantanamo in 2013, military officials denied for months. When they did finally acknowledge that there were over 100 people on strike, they said that this was sort of a propaganda campaign by, you know, detainees and their lawyers to try to get attention. So, again, nothing new, but inhumane.
Ardit, you've spoken about the son, Mohammed, who went in when he was roughly 17, I think is what you wrote in the article and have said. Mm-hmm. What about the father? Did he get to see his father? How was that carried out in the prison, and what happened ultimately?
You know, they were both in such tremendous pain, but it really manifested differently. Mohammed was young. He was really vocal and loud about his torture. And I remember being in meetings and just hearing him kind of yell and scream. And it was just, you know, it kind of shook me every time we talked. And particularly after he cut his wrist, we had a phone call where I called him from a secret facility in D.C. where we had to go to be able to make somewhat confidential calls to Guantanamo, and just listening to him scream into my ear saying, you know, please do something. I can't take it anymore. With Abdel Nasser, you know, his pain was quieter. He was, he's such a sad, you know, it was really heartbreaking meeting with him because he was just so sad. And I think I write in the piece that there was a different kind of pain for people who'd left a wife behind, left other children behind. I think Abdel Nasser thought a lot about the rest of his family. And I think felt very responsible and guilty because, you know, he had left, Abdel Nasser and Mohammed are Syrians, but Abdel Nasser had left Syria in 2000, wanted to resettle his family somewhere where he thought there would be a better opportunity, economic opportunity. He was a cook in Aleppo, worked in a restaurant, struggled making a living, wanted ultimately to open a restaurant somewhere else, had a hard time gaining entry into a lot of countries. So he ended up in Afghanistan for a short period of time, called for the rest of his family to join him just 3 months before 9/11, having no idea what was coming. And then when the attacks happened and he got word the U.S. was planning to bomb Afghanistan, he took his family and they fled. And Mohammed and Abdel Nasser, they split up. Some of them went one way, others of them went another way. And Mohammed and Abdel Nasser were seized as they were fleeing and crossing the border into Pakistan and basically turned over to the U.S. for bounty. We know that the CIA was paying millions of dollars to the Pakistani government and Afghan warlords to profile and turn people over, basically sell them into U.S. custody. But I think he felt very responsible for, you know, what had happened because he had called for his family to join him, again, having no idea what was coming. But he was in a lot of pain just thinking about his family.
Pardis, what was the theory or the claim that they held him in Guantanamo for, I guess he was almost in the first batch. He came in right a month after it opened in 2002, I guess February or so. And then they held him until the, quote, release, because they're in separate places now, for 5 years or so. Well, under what grounds? I mean, it's just your story and the story you wrote about. There doesn't seem to be even anything. I mean, nothing except that they happened to be fleeing the bombing that was going to happen in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, we know that early on that there were just mass sweeps that were happening of people, basically Arabs and Afghans of men of military age, just mass sweeps that were happening of people in a particular area in Afghanistan and sort of crossing into Pakistan. They were being profiled. So initially, I think they came into U.S. hands because they were profiled and sort of unilaterally deemed by President Bush and Rumsfeld to be enemy combatants without any real, not just, you know, lawyers and groups like CCR saying that. There are commanders, the first commander, Commander Leonard, who was tasked with setting up Camp X-Ray, the infamous cages of Guantanamo in the early years, has said himself in recent years in op-eds he's written that, you know, most of the people that we held at Guantanamo were mistakes and should never have been there. You've got senior State Department officials like Wilkerson is one State Department official who was in daily briefings in the State Department under Colin Powell listening to, you know, information about detainees and has talked about how there was recognition that most of the people at Guantanamo, of the hundreds who were there, were wrongfully there, but that it was politically infeasible to release them because Rumsfeld and Bush and, you know, senior officials had spent so long saying that all these people at Guantanamo were the worst of the worst and dangerous terrorists. So politically, it was impossible to release them after having, you know, said these were all the guys who were involved in 9/11 and responsible for 9/11, and they were all dangerous terrorists, to then sort of acknowledge that actually no, hundreds of them were mistakes and shouldn't be there. So at a certain level, there was no evidence. There was no evidence that Mohammed and Abdel Nasser were involved in any wrongdoing or were associated with any kind of terrorism. When the first time the government ever put out any kind of public record of, or where we saw any kind of public record of the allegations, was in the CSRT, the Totally Discredited Combatant Status Review Tribunal, the military panels that were set up in 2004 by Bush to circumvent the Supreme Court's decision in Rasool versus Bush, CCR's case, you know, that allowed detainees the right to challenge the legality of their detention in federal court. These tribunals sprung up as sort of this substitute for habeas review, and they were completely biased, not impartial. You know, detainees had no right to see the evidence, the classified evidence against them, couldn't call witnesses. I mean, they were just, their hands were completely tied. They were entirely unfair, and they've been discredited in the years since.
Pardis, to get back to the story at hand,
The good news is Mohammed and his father did ultimately get out of Guantanamo. Can you quickly summarize that and what happened?
That's one of the most moving scenes in your article, and I just think it's extraordinary.
So in 2009, when President Obama came into office, he set up a task force to review the government's information on everyone who was being held at the time. There were 242 people in Guantanamo in 2009 when he took over. There was a government review, and 126 of them were cleared to leave. They were approved for transfer. Some of those men remain in Gitmo today. But Mohammed and Abdel Nasser were cleared, like those 126 other people. Back in 2009, there were more diligent efforts the Obama administration was making to actually release people. So Portugal came forward to offer resettlement to Mohammed. He feared torture under Assad in Syria. They didn't want to go back to Syria. They couldn't. They needed third countries. And so Portugal was one of the first European countries to come forward and offer safe haven. The issue was that it was interested in taking Mohammed and didn't express interest in taking his father. And that's just sort of, the way that these decisions are made and people are transferred is such a lottery. It's so arbitrary. And I think Abdel Nasser probably appeared to be more of a burden, frankly, to them because he was older, in ill health, and they didn't take him. They wanted a younger guy who they thought would be easier to resettle. So there was this moment in Guantanamo when Mohammed was faced with his freedom, faced with the prospect of release versus leaving his father behind. And he was completely distraught. And at that point, he hadn't seen his dad for 4 years. And we got an hour for them. We asked for a meeting from the military to allow Mohammed to see his father and basically ask for his blessing. And it's one of the most, that moment is just completely seared in my memory. They had an hour. There were rules for the meeting. They were allowed one embrace at the beginning, one at the end. They couldn't touch in between. And, it was just this moment. They hadn't seen each other in years, and they had to sort of say hello and say goodbye, and Mohammed had to ask for his father's blessing, and then that was it. And in the end, at the end of the meeting, they embraced each other. They got their last embrace, and Abdel Nasser was shuffled out of the room. And that was the last time they've seen each other. It's now 2015. Mohammed was transferred to Portugal in 2009. Abdel Nasser got resettlement in Cape Verde in 2010. And since then, they've been held apart. And that's in part because of the collateral consequences of detention that continue even after release that have gotten so little attention. It's just what life is like for people after Guantanamo. There's been zero accountability, we know, but there are also many ways that the stigma follows them, that certain restrictions on the terms of transfer continue to impede their lives. And the travel restrictions are one. So Mohammed and Abdel Nasser have literally not been allowed to see each other in the 6 years since that meeting. And they haven't been allowed to rejoin with the rest of their family. So in the intervening years, their family in Syria has been displaced because of the war there. They're now refugees in Turkey. His mom, Mohammed's mother and his other two siblings are living as refugees in Turkey, and they're apart as well. So the family is just sort of in these three corners of the earth waiting to be together. And part of the point of this story was to shed light on just what life is like after Guantanamo, to say that it is not recidivism, which is the only thing people seem to talk about when it comes to the aftermath of Guantanamo, that life goes on, but that it is also hard and there's a struggle and there's continuing pain that we need to be aware of. And their specific request is to be together. So there's a petition that CCR has formulated, in connection with this article, asking people to sign on so that we can take these signatures to officials of Portugal, Cape Verde, and the U.S., asking for this family to be reunited after all these years. Abdel Nasser has not seen his wife since 2001. He hasn't seen his other children since 2001. He hasn't seen Mohammed since that day in Guantanamo in 2009. So it's the most basic right, as Mohammed says, is the right to be with your family, and that's what they're asking for now.
So, Pardis, is that on the CCR website that we can go to?
Yeah, it's ccrjustice.org/reunification after Guantanamo.
I wanted to ask you to step back, and when you reflect on this, what do we learn from this really cruel story that you tell in your Harper Magazine article? What do we learn from it?
I think when I wanted to tell this story for so long because there were so many moments when I was with Mohammed and Abdel Nasser where I just wanted the public to be a fly on the wall and to witness the moments of pain, but also deep, deep humanity in Guantanamo. And I thought that if people could see that, could sort of be up close the way I was, the way others of us have been, that it would just shatter the myths that continue about who we've held. So part of the point was to try to bring people into the room and up close, which is hard to do because so much of what we know and what comes out of Guantanamo is filtered and censored. And then, of course, the U.S. public never interacts directly, never gets direct exposure, because when people are released, they're obviously not coming to the U.S. So there's a way that publics in Europe and in other countries have been exposed and been able to interact with former detainees that we don't get in the U.S. public. So this narrative about dangerous terrorists just continues in this way in the U.S. It's very hard to penetrate. And the other point was to counter this fear narrative about releasing detainees and to say that, yes, there is struggle. There is certainly struggle. After Guantanamo and a lack of accountability and a lack of acknowledgement of what we have done to hundreds of people and their families and communities, but that life also goes on and that there is a certain recovery and rebuilding that happens. And so the story was really painful to witness and, you know, witness all these years. But there's also been moments of rebuilding and recovering. And the end of the piece is Mohammed, you know, the birth of his daughter, his child. And I wanted to show that, to say, you know, that life goes on, there is rebuilding. And those are the hundreds of stories that we don't hear about. It's not about these recidivism statistics that senators like Tom Cotton used to, you know, to argue that the prison should stay open.
Yeah, he should walk into it. Pardis, thank you very much. Your article, Life After Guantanamo, is in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. We can link to it at lawanddisorder.org. And we truly appreciate really everything you've done, not just by writing this article, but by your wonderful representation. Mm-hmm. Proud to be in the same bar with you.
Pardis, it was incredibly moving. And as I wrote you this morning after reading it for the second time, it just moved me to tears again. It's really beautiful.
Thank you.
Great
Thank
job.
Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you all.
Bye, Pardis.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.